Good evening, this is Gary Kavanagh here on the right side with my friend and colleague Michael Dwyer. Today is the first day of December, which means it's the day when Christmas music can legally be played. It'll be a terrible shame for all of us. So, today's stories. We want to talk about the terrorist attack, or at least suspected terrorist attack, on London Bridge. We want to talk about the grovelling apology that RTE has offered Kevin Myers for calling him a Holocaust denier. And we want to very briefly talk about the by-elections, I'm hoping in 60 seconds or less. Michael, the London Bridge attack. Have you, so for those who have somehow missed this, possibly because this is your only way of getting news, and we haven't talked about it yet, there was a terrorist attack on London Bridge. A man with a knife, I believe, has killed two people. He was, shall we say, detained by members of the public, then members of the security services, then he was shot in the head while he was on the ground. And that's pretty much the long and the short of it. There are some amazing videos, though. The members of the public who... after he had killed, I think, one person, or possibly both people by that point, three members of the public basically corralled him, one of them with a 5-foot-long narwhal horn, basically a spear, and the other by just firing a fire extinguisher into his face repeatedly.
I thought he was a wonderful example of on-the-spot creative thinking. Apparently, I don't know what this is. There's the Fisherman's Hall or something. I don't know if it's a museum.
This one, I believe, was a Polish chef who was working in the Fisherman's Hall.
And he went back in, got hold of this narwhal. For those who don't know, a narwhal is something which looks a bit like a cross between a dolphin and a seal and has a long, pointy beak at the end. Some people...
Basically a unicorn.
A sea-going...
In the sea.
Yeah, a sea-going unicorn. And the horn was used at times in the medieval period as when these things were found as believed to be proof that this actually was the remains of a unicorn. And he got hold of this. The other guy got hold of a fire extinguisher and fired off. And it was... We know from years of psychologists doing tests on it that there is a group hesitancy to act when awful things occur. You see large groups of people standing and observing them, and people tend to think that it's God, these people are so callous or whatever. But it's a psychological reaction that people become frozen and incapable of acting. These people were extraordinary and incredible, much to be admired that they managed to break through that just natural reaction and to take the guy down. And physically a very brave thing to do. The attacker was, I believe, Usman Khan, and he had been jailed over a terror plot previously.
Yes, he had been. And one of the people who apparently managed to take him to the ground and disarm him was a convicted murderer out on day release.
Yes. The whole thing is kind of rich with kind of horrific ironies.
He had a knife. He was wearing what he said was a suicide vest, which subsequently turned out to be a fake vest. But that wasn't known at the time.
No.
So he gets taken down by members of the public. Police forces show up. They pull back. He tries to get up. They shoot him in the head. I will make one point. The thing you were talking about there, that people will freeze in large groups, the validity of that is questioned. A lot of that research on bystander effect, I mean, the most famous case was Kitty Genovese, I think.
Kitty Genovese case is controversial.
Yeah, so when they that was the original one. There were 38 or 40 witnesses, I think, and apparently none of them intervened or called the police. And it was only in 2007 when someone went back and actually looked at it, and it turned out that there were way less witnesses. The police were called during the attack, and most of the people who could hear it couldn't see it. So, yeah, we're not sure if that research is actually valid at all. It may, in fact, just be another point in the wonderful book of social psychology experiments that totally failed to replicate. Which, if you've done a degree in social psychology, let's say within the last 40 years, nothing you were taught is true and everything is totally worthless.
I think baby and bathwater are the phrases that occurred to me on that observation, but of the two people that...
I say that slightly joking.
Slightly. Of the two people that were murdered, one was a woman whose name has not been released yet. The other was a young man, a Cambridge graduate, Jack Merritt. And again, in the the ghastly ironies of the case, he was a course coordinator for a thing called Learning Together, which is a rehab program for prisoners, which was hosting a conference at the Fishmongers Hall, which is at the north end of the London Bridge. And Usman Khan had in fact taken part in the scheme while in prison and was one of the people attending the event.
Yes, he was. He was at the Learning Together event and decided that a stabbing rampage was the way to go after that.
It's the scary...
I mean, some things can just break a man.
The scary thing about this kind of attack is how you can't stop it. There's nothing you can do to stop somebody getting hold of some sharp butcher's knives and then just going into a group of people. How can you predict it?
No, it's one of the things I note with the gun debate in America, and people are like, we have to take the guns away from people so that people can be safe. The average person has the capability to kill another person, either the physical strength, they don't have the desire to do it.
Yeah.
But if people wanted to just kill their neighbour, it would actually be shockingly easy to do it. I mean, the average kitchen is filled with a variety of chemicals and implements that would function perfectly well. The average person is more than capable of making chlorine gas in their kitchen.
Yes.
Don't do it. But that's the problem with these attacks. The potential weapons and potential things you can use against other people are everywhere because people don't use them. And I'm not sure you can actually strip society of all those things.
Well, no, you can't. You couldn't do it and leave it as a functioning place.
No, I mean, like, the average artist will have dozens of things that can poison you. They don't. They just don't do it.
Yeah, but so where are we? What do we do? I mean, how do you approach? How do you deal with this kind of thing?
Well, I believe the British police approach was to shoot him in the head, which I will say, Michael, I've seen people on Twitter and they've been unhappy about that. But I will say this. The reoffence rate is very low.
I'm sure it is, but without being facetious about it, when they shot him in the head, it was rather too late for two people.
Yes, yeah, it was. And the problem there is that police should not shoot people in the head before they have stabbed other people. It's really creating the problem it's trying to stop. Well,
it's not so much creating it, but moving it. That instead of seeing a guy with a beard and a bag of knives coming at you, when you see a policeman, that's when you get scared.
It could be very it could really show us how to appreciate the experiences of the black community in America.
Well, I suppose now you're talking about social psychology and experiments. I mean, let's not get into that, but there have been quite a few rather wide ranging studies done in the last 18 months which suggest that if you're talking about the use of fatal force, that actually there is no... The evidence suggests that black men are actually not subjected to disproportionate levels of fatal force by the police.
I've also seen...
In the United States, Ronald Breyer's study was one, and then there was another study out of Houston. But let's not get... But seriously, I mean, how do you do it? I mean, is this ultimately the responsibility of the community from which these people spring? Is it the mosque that has to start taking a more active... But to be fair, I mean, I've seen articles written and people talking that saying that actually that mosques in Britain, we shouldn't be flippant about this, have actually been very active in this area, and people are constantly contacting the police and reporting individuals.
The problem here is this. Police are generally not proactive as such. They'll keep eyes on things, and if they think something is going to happen, then they will intervene before it. But in general, in relation to killings, they are reactive. They turn up after and they find out who did it, and they then imprison that person. Well, sorry, they don't, but that's a, you get the idea of that.
Yeah.
Someone who's willing to just go on a single killing spree with no clear inputs up to that point and no real intention to survive it, so no repeat behaviour, is very difficult to track.
Yeah, what do you...
Also, the ways in which you would track them, or the ways that, let's say, the Israelis track these things, would probably be deemed in the most of the West as racist and offensive.
How so?
Well, the Israelis tend to use like ethnicity, religion, as a basis for their security operations or for their analysis of suspects.
Profile, which a form of profiling.
Yeah, it is racial and religious profiling. Mm-hmm. People in the West are generally very uncomfortable with, even if it's effective. And the Israelis, just on the Israeli example, it appears to be very effective. But lone killers are very hard to find.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say, well, maybe they're radicalized by certain things and you can watch those things and you can log anyone who goes onto it. But it's not terribly difficult to get around most surveillance capabilities. The assumption is that the person looking for it is just not of sophistication to do that. So, they are very effective, though.
My impression, you've been in London more recently than me. My impression the last couple of times I've been there is that the police in London are an awful lot more armed than they used to be. That you will see more armed police around the city than you might expect from an unarmed police force. But do you think this, if we are just going to say, listen, okay, we'll do our best, we'll use whatever intelligence we can, but that at the moment, this may simply be the kind of event that we're going to have to learn to live with in the societies, that in our societies, because of events, because of history, because of whatever. And that maybe this is the kind of thing that ultimately leads to a fully armed police force. Because if you want a cop nearby, you want the cop to have a gun in a case like this.
Yeah, I mean, the British police are much more armed than Irish police. But I don't think they're all armed.
No, they're not.
Sufficiently armed. I don't know. You can do things like that and they will reduce the severity of attacks because intervention is more rapid and generally more final. So you're going to get a lot more dead suspects.
Yeah, obviously.
Which, again, yeah. People might have a problem with. You may also get a lot more dead times when something hasn't quite happened and police think something might happen. And then they shoot that person.
You're going to get also dead bystanders. There's at least a decent chance of that. It always used to strike me when you're walking around Milan that depending where you are, you'd see some of the Carabinieri would have rifles and pistols. And that kind of made sense because for accuracy. But some of them used to have Uzis or Berettas, submachine guns. And as a friend of mine who had been in the army, the Italian army, said to me, it's purely for show. Because if you're in the middle of the Galleria in Milan and you take, apparently, these things spray, is that the word? And if you were to use that, all you'd hit were, there's no accuracy to this at all. And you'd inevitably hit.
What kind of weapon are you talking about?
Submachine guns, like a Beretta or an Uzi?
No, submachine guns will generally have a selection option where you can go from one round, three round burst. To full auto. I mean, yeah, if you're on full auto, you're going to fire pretty weirdly. But no, they can actually be quite accurate. Pistols are very inaccurate at close range.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing you have, if you arm police more, people may just go for different methods. So they might move from knives to explosives. And that will heighten the bar for those people to get involved because they're more difficult to do those things. But they can absolutely be done. I mean, the reason I mentioned chlorine gas earlier is because it's incredibly easy to make. Here's a headline from 2017 from Britain. House proud mother keen to mop her floor extra clean accidentally creates chlorine gas in her kitchen.
So how do you do it? You get ammonia and...
Chlorine gas is just bleach. Like if you have, let's say you have Dettol and you have bleach and you have hot water.
Yeah.
That's enough to make chlorine gas.
Well, it was my suspicion that I was gassed in a hotel in Belfast. Some time ago where I walked into it, the stink of bleach in it was absolutely overpowering. And when I came away after spending a day and a half in the place, or a night and a half in the place, my I seemed to be going into, I had full blown asthma, and one of the suggestions my doctor said was that possibly it'd been irritated by, in fact, this, I'd been exposed to what essentially was chlorine gas. I don't know if that's right, but that's what he said.
This, I think, is going to be the high point of the show.
Indeed.
That time we told people how to manufacture chlorine gas. But if you mix bleach with anything with ammonia, acid, or anything with ammonia, acids, or oftentimes any other cleaner, you will make chlorine gas. I found out how to make it through a children's science book from the 50s. It was fantastic because it was fully sort of coloured and everything was... It was just... It had come with a... someone gave it to me as a gift, but it had come with like a beginner's science set that you'd give to, like, I think it was aged for 10 to 12 year olds. And it was all these, you know, happy kind of experiments and, you know, how to make a lightning jump from things. And then I turned the page and it's this really happy-go-lucky style, except it's now people in gas masks in trenches. It was just, how to make chlorine gas?
Is chlorine gas the same as mustard gas?
No.
I can't remember if it was chlorine gas or something, but you saw the book. We actually did the experiment on live animals, in a sense, in school, where we were, you know those gas cabinets that you have in the lab and you're driving a gas off? And I think it was experimenting driving chlorine gas off. There was a big vask of water and we put something in and this gas went off. But the teacher forgot that he'd put two guys out of the class around 10 minutes before it who were standing directly underneath the extraction fan outside. And we were doing this experiment, and then after a while we could hear all this coughing going on. And suddenly the teacher goes, oh, fuck, runs out, grabs the two of them. Now, nothing ever happened. I don't think he, possibly. It was in a less litigious time. I think today if a teacher gassed a couple of his students, he might even get a disciplinary letter.
Yeah, well, mustard gas is an odd one. Because it's also visible. It's sort of I think it's a kind of a yellowish-brown colour.
Yeah.
So you could see it coming. Mm. So it wasn't... It was also a weapon of terror, in that once it was set out, you just see this cloud coming at you.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, well, this is not going to make my day any better. So it's also a... I'm actually not even sure if it's gas. It's called a gas, but I've heard that it's actually really fine droplets. But it would cause... Mustard gas, if you were to breathe it, would effectively just... burn your lungs apart.
I think
it would burn your skin, your eyes.
I remember seeing an interview with a guy who was saying that at the very beginning when they were experimenting with it, that they didn't necessarily always, they weren't always equipped with gas masks. And when they launched one of these early attacks of mustard, you could see this cloud going out. And without warning, the weather conditions changed. And it started, and it came back, which can't have been a pleasant experience, seeing this gas which had been launched towards the German lines and now was rolling back towards you.
Oh, just on the chlorine gas point, that's why you're not meant to use a toilet that's covered in bleach, because there's ammonia in urine.
Yes.
So if you urinate on the bleach, you may actually gas yourself. Probably not severely. Take it as a general rule that it's better to not be chlorine gassed at all.
At all, yeah.
Than to be gassed a little bit.
So, I suppose, as we wait to see if the day comes and we, not the, that this kind of thing happens, not on Dublin Bridge, but on O'Connell Bridge, I suppose, we observe these things and worry, I suppose, powerlessly. It feels like there's not a whole lot any of us can do. Just hope that we happen to, not none of us or our loved ones happen to be about if and when it happens. Anyway, I suppose...
Kevin Myers.
God, this feels like a long time ago, doesn't it?
I've generally found, Michael, that if there's someone says something and then 2 years later there's an apology, even if no one will comment, you can probably safely assume there was a court case. And it was a pretty grovelling apology. But then again, I mean, it's not that you may not know, but you may have forgotten... Kevin Myers got into a bit of trouble because he said something about a Jewish woman that I think that Jews...
There were two.
Jews were not a people who tended to undersell themselves to agents.
He was referring, I think, to two women on the BBC, one of whom was... Oh, God, I can't remember her. She used to be on the telly like a rash, large, loud lady with blonde hair. And he basically... He was saying that they were savvy businesswomen. But it did sound a little bit like he was speaking into that trope of Jews and money and that kind of rather unpleasant stereotype. I think one of the processes was somebody did a Google search, and amongst all of it, they came across an article, the headline of which was, "I am a Holocaust denier," and didn't seem to bother to read the rest of the article.
Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, you're like, it's a terrible headline, but writers generally don't choose the headlines.
No, some editor will do that, or somebody else will do it. But if you'd read the article, and also, it was Kevin Myers. I mean, Kevin Myers.
Well known.
Anybody who'd been paying attention would know that whatever Kevin Myers was, and he many, many things, he was not a Holocaust denier.
I liked the fact that Kevin Myers has had like kind of a long involvement with kind of pro-Israeli and pro-Jewish groups. So his article was published in, I think, the Sunday Times,
yeah,
which is published in Britain as well.
Yes.
So he was being attacked as an anti-Semite in Britain. Well, the Jewish groups in Ireland were basically saying, I mean, Kevin Myers is not an anti-Semite, lads.
Oh, it became,
that's ridiculous. I mean, the Times of Israel, the Jewish news, published a blog about it.
Yeah, there was a guy, I think an Irish Jew, who was then living in Israel, who knew Myers personally and wrote an article for the blog for the Times of Israel. I do remember one quote. I have an idea who said it, but I'm not absolutely sure. Who said, talking about whether or not he said this, I don't need to know anymore. And I always think that's a very worrying attitude to the person. You make a hardline statement about somebody or about an incident, and then you follow it up with, I don't need to know anymore. Well, you know, I think it's a good principle in life to try and find out a little bit more. And then you find out that it became a heated issue between Irish Jewry and English Jewry, and the Irish Jewish community saying, no, this is a good guy. We like him. He's not a Holocaust denier. He's talked about the importance of remembering the Holocaust and the horror of it, and criticized people who downplay it, but it didn't matter. Now, we won't know, because I'm absolutely sure that there is, as there usually is in situations like this, a non-disclosure agreement as part of the settlement. But when you consider the fact that it basically finished his career as a journalist, it made him a non-person, it made him an object of contempt and ridicule. And the old standard for libel and slander cases was the effect that it had on your reputation amongst your peers. Well, this had a savage effect on him personally and on his capacity to make a living.
I mean, this pretty much ended him.
Yeah. So you got to wonder what figures were involved. I suspect, and this was RTE, so I get, not an organization which is without its money difficulties. I suspect that there was a substantial settlement involved, something that will enable Kevin to go on some very nice holidays in his now retirement.
Let's see, they paid 85,000 when they called Iona, John Waters and five other people in the Iona Institute. I think they said they were homophobic.
Yes.
That was, in comparison to this, unbelievably mild.
Yes.
So I would say Kevin Myers is now probably a very wealthy man, I think would be safe to say.
Comfortably off. Probably has earned more than he would have done as a journalist. Now,
also the fact that they fought this.
Yes.
These cases are very expensive to run. And I think I think the Iona case, although I'm not certain, they basically took it far enough to see Iona were serious and then just went, fine, what do you want? And they would have known how badly they had screwed up here. So the fact that they refused to settle for 2 years would probably indicate that Myers wanted a great deal of money off them.
You think that was what held it up? Yeah.
Well, I think if they had if they had thought they could pay him a small amount and just get rid of him,
yeah,
they probably would have done it. Because if you remember, the BAI came out in 2018, the Broadcasting Association of Ireland, and said it was unfair for Morning Ireland to have called him a Holocaust denier.
Yes.
So that's over a year ago. That's a year and three quarters. And they didn't stop it, which meant that they knew the BAI had said it was unfair. And at that point, if it was only a small amount of money, and that would be an indication you're going to lose, you'd probably kind of go, okay, yeah, end this.
I wonder, will this mean that we will see Kevin Myers return to journalism?
I suspect it will.
I hope it does. I mean, I have not always agreed with Kevin's take on a number of things. I've agreed with him wholeheartedly on others. But you know that phrase that Douglas Murray likes to use? It's a quote from Mencken, J.L. Mencken, the American libertarian and satirist. He said that most of the advances in human civilization have been caused by people heaving cats into sanctuaries and then roistering along their way, happy with the job well done. And what this world needs are more dead cat heavers. And I certainly think in the Irish media, we need more people throwing dead cats around the place. I think that his absence we have missed that. So I think the Times are unlikely to, the Irish Times or the Sunday Times are likely to take him back. Maybe the Indo.
I don't know. I think he may feel, I don't know Kevin Myers, my hole in the ground.
Yeah.
I think we have mutual friends, but I've never actually met the man. I've never talked to him. So I don't want to say what he will or won't do. But I would imagine this has removed rather substantial cloud over him. And if it was that substantial of a payout, he might kind of be going, well, why not? Want to go back to write?
Because one thing was never in doubt, and that's he can write.
He is a fine writer.
He's a very, and that is something which is very scarce in the current firmament of Irish journalism. He's a very, very fine writer, and he holds you. He can take a narrative. The stuff he did on the North was really, it's grippy stuff. Do you ever read anything his stuff on the Balkan Wars, Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia?
I've read part of it. The stuff he did on the Holocaust, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that might have been the moment where people, because numerous people called him a Holocaust denier, where people kind of were sent screenshots of pages of his book, then there might have been a sort of, we have fucked up.
Maybe. Just maybe we got this guy wrong. But
yeah,
there is one little thing that did occur to me, thinking about this. People have long opined that the Irish libel laws, slant defamation laws, in fact, we don't have libel anymore, are a mess. And that it restricts newspapers and journalists because it's too easy to sue for libel in this country, say in comparison to the United States. And we're in the middle of a discussion at the moment where both you and I are very concerned about movements that are being made at a government level towards restricting free speech. It's a tricky old balance to strike, because the other thing is Kevin Myers, well, possibly because his case was just so slam dunk and he felt it was something he absolutely had to do because the accusation was so hard. It's hard to take a libel case, Gary, unless you have funds.
It is. It's very difficult to take a libel case. I don't know. I mean, we have very strict libel laws. I mean, there's been numerous times we've wanted to talk about something that's newsworthy or that we were like, oh, no one else has that, we should talk about it. And then there was a sort of, yeah, we could end up in court for that very,
very, very,
very easily.
Yeah.
And I know GRIPT as an entity is numerous things that we know but we can't publish, because where are we to receive, where someone to come back against you on it, you simply wouldn't be able to go into a court and provide anything that a court would find compelling.
And I've been the presence of a prominent public figure who was having a very good lunch and commented at one stage when somebody said something about, oh, the cost of something. He said, oh, I'm fine. At the time he said, I've six cases getting ready for the High Court. These things keep me in more than decent pocket money.
Yeah, but then, I mean, would you want to, you could go the other way and someone could say Kevin Myers is a Holocaust denier, and that could be perfectly acceptable. They could say that was their honest opinion of Kevin Myers.
Yeah, I know. I reckon it's not an easy or obvious issue.
No, and the media narrative on this is generally that the laws have to be changed because they're restricting. But on the other hand, I would look at some of the American, some of the things that American newspapers can print, and you sort of go, maybe you should be restricted.
It's virtually impossible to defame a public figure in the United States. You have to basically, you have to say something which is untrue, which is damaging. You have to know that it was untrue, and you have to be malicious in publication. I'm not an American lawyer, obviously, but that's my understanding. But certainly, if you're a public figure, your protections are very, very low indeed. And if you've ever read the National Enquirer, I mean, some of the stuff, you think, how in the name of God? But having said that, there have been some very prominently successful libel cases in the United States in recent history. What was that case? The online snooping news guys who got sunk?
It wasn't Gawker Media.
Was it a libel case that got them?
Well, I think it was pissing off Peter Thiel that got them.
Yeah, well, yes, he was waiting in the long grass.
So Hulk Hogan sued Gawker for posting a sex tape he had. And Thiel basically bankrolled Hulk Hogan's actual case. So I think I don't think it was actually defamation.
No, it would have been expectation of privacy.
It was invasion of privacy, and I think intentional infliction of emotional harm and distress.
Yeah, yeah.
And it drove Gawker into bankruptcy. Thiel was apparently unhappy with Gawker because Gawker had Peter Thiel as an American businessman. I was going to say on the right, but slightly complicated.
Wait,
actually.
He's a libertarian.
He's a libertarian, but he's the sort of libertarian who makes statements like, I no longer believe democracy and freedom are compatible.
Yeah, but that's not uncommon amongst libertarians.
It's not uncommon among sensible people, Michael. But anyway.
Let's just make you king, Gary.
Divine mandate is really what this country needs.
Yeah.
But they had revealed that Thiel was gay. I think Thiel was at that time on a business trip to the Middle East.
Right.
In a place where you really don't want to have now been publicly outed as a homosexual. And for years, he just carried a torch to burn that place down.
You know,
and he did. He destroyed an entire media empire to do it.
You don't want to do that to a billionaire. A billionaire with the capacity to hold a grudge is a bad enemy to make.
Yeah, I mean, I think they kind of went Hulk Hogan. He's kind of washed up. We can do what we want.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, Hulk Hogan has got some incredible legal representation. And there's a lot of people working on this for him.
Yeah.
Oh.
Oops.
Like he seems to be getting very well prepped. Oh, God. Oh, and then, I mean, that trial was fantastic. There was a point in it where they, the Gawker trial is worth a look back at some point, but they asked one of the Gawker editors where they would draw the line, because they said the sex tape was newsworthy. And the guy went, well, it was Gawker's former editor-in-chief, and Hulk Hogan's lawyers went, can you imagine a situation where a celebrity sex tape would not be newsworthy? And the response was, if they were a child. And Hulk Hogan's lawyers say, under what age? And Gawker's former editor said, 4.
4?
4. And then they had to put out a press release later saying, we were being flippant about that. That was a joke.
Right.
But I think by the end of it, they had acted so badly, even the judge was sort of like, I'm just going to bring the hammer down here.
Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Anyway, well done, Kevin. I hope he enjoys his settlement. And I also, if in the unlikely circumstance that he or somebody who knows him ever gets to hear this, I would say, Kevin, please come back and write some more, because I think you would be a welcome addition to the journalistic.
We could get him and Vincent Brown on a podcast.
Oh, yeah.
5 minutes of chatting, you'll hear the noise of someone standing up and then someone being hit by a chair. And you won't quite know who.
That is the channel I would almost pay. I would almost pay to hear. Anyway, let's finish up with just quick look, shall we? Today was by-election results.
Yes, yeah, so I don't have a lot to say on these things, so I'll mostly let you talk, Michael. The standard results were Fianna Fáil got 2, the Greens got 1, Sinn Féin got 1, Fine Gael did not. I think Verona Murphy, she of the racist comments controversy, although whatever you think of that, I think she did the best out of the Fine Gael candidates, which is also interesting. However, the turnout was unbelievably low, below 30%. So basically, at that turnout, only a couple of people turn up. Those who are incredibly invested in politics, and those who have a burning ideological drive. So, you know, the Greens, the hard Greens will come out. The Socialists will come out. And then the guys who are just deep into the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and Labour ecosystem. The problem is that's not the turnout at general elections. So there's a lot of people now saying, well, this is terribly bad for Leo in looking at the general election, or this is, you know, this is a clear sign of what's going to happen. I don't think so. I think the turnout was so low that this could have really gone anyway. I don't think, other than the fact that Fine Gael got nothing, it was thought they might get 1. I don't think there was anything terribly surprising here. But just with the turnout, I don't think you can use this as a bellwether for anything. I don't think people will. Because God knows, you know, a paper will not refuse ink. But
okay, yeah.
I don't think I've ever been so bored of a general or a by-election either.
Yes, turnout was low. If you look at Wexford, the turnout in Wexford was something like 20... I can't remember. It was 25% in Fine Gael, 26% in Dublin. It was 35% in Wexford. In the last general election, turnout in Wexford would have been around 65%. Turnout in Fine Gael would have been around 65%. So the turnout in Fine Gael was considerably more suppressed even than Wexford. A lot of people say, oh, well, the results are, the turnout is so low. I don't necessarily buy that completely. I think it is distorting. It still is a poll, and it's a poll where people go to vote. Yes, I think I still think that it's a problem for Fine Gael. If you look at Wexford, which is where I thought there were other people who thought the Dublin Midwest. I thought O'Reilly that might have a chance there. The Green result, I suppose, that's Trevor Sargent's old seat. Maybe that's a recurrence. And a Green is the kind of thing maybe classically you might expect from a by-election with an unpopular government. It's a decent result for Fianna Fáil, but it's not spectacular. The one I was most... There are two results I was curious to see, other than obviously the result. I thought Malcolm Byrne did well, but not spectacular. But
do you think he'll manage to take it in the general?
Ooh.
I mean, he's a fairly good candidate. The only thing anyone really ever brings up about Malcolm Byrne in a negative is that, I wouldn't say assault, but the whole weirdness about that thing with a woman when he was younger.
I don't think anybody in his constituency particularly cares about
it. No, I don't think it's terribly important. I don't think it was meant to have been anything serious, but it's the only thing I've seen people bring up about him that isn't at best, or you know, at worst, neutral.
People might say the most interesting thing about Malcolm is that he's gay. He was outed by a local paper here in what was actually a despicable fashion, done by, they were tipped off by somebody, probably somebody involved in local politics here. It was a nasty turn and made a very nasty turn by the papers. The way they did it was horrible. They rang him up and told him that they were running with the story, they were going to break it on the news. and he had 5 or 6 hours to tell his parents. That kind of, it actually made, in a weird way, maybe it was the best thing for him because it short circuited the process of having to do it himself. And he got absolutely no negative response by the local people. Local people were very supportive of him. And it was a horrible thing for someone to do, to be treated like that. No, I thought it was interesting. I was interested in Clifford Lee's result because I think that you were right that the person that was actually hurt by, if we want to call it a little scandal that happened during it, I think that she was hurt by the comments that were dredged up, the tweets.
I tell you, no one cares about the racism.
Yeah.
But you make a comment that could relate to someone's daughters, that'll do you.
And I thought that in the context of that, allowing for the turnout, she got, I think, what was it, around 21%? I didn't think she did badly, whether or not they run her again. But to me, that's indicative that in places like Fianna Fáil is a presence again, you know. We have to remember, it's not that long ago that after Brian Lennon, when Brian Lennon was held his seat and then died, there was a period where Fianna Fáil did not exist in Dublin. And there were a lot of very wise men saying that that was the end of Fianna Fáil in Dublin, that they would never recover. I think they are recovering across the city. We're never going to see the great days of the 70s where they were the dominant force in working class politics in Dublin. But I think that they are, if they're figuring again in constituencies like Fine Gael, they're going to be present across the city, and if they can start to be moving towards a situation where they're picking up one seat in all those constituencies, well, that's decent news for them.
I mean, the Clifford Lee thing I think is interesting because in the final tally, she gets annihilated.
Yeah.
So O'Brien is at like 12,000. She's down at about 7,000.
Yeah.
But she got to the last count with him. And at that point, he was on about 9,000 and she's on about 6,500.
Yeah.
So I think at that point, you're down to transfers, obviously.
Yes.
And that's the point where you don't want to have pissed people off.
Yes. That's where you want people not to be at least neutral about you, that they don't really mind either way. If you've pissed people off, in that kind of, that you're going to transfer.
And it wasn't, so Duncan Smith goes out the round before, and Duncan's Labour, so maybe there might be a leaning more to the Greens. But I mean, you're looking at, I mean, she only took 1,000 of his vote, whereas O'Brien goes from 9 to 12.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't have thought there was that much of a tendency towards the Greens there.
Again, it'll be one of those things we will see. We will see when it comes to...
Also, Riley got just annihilated.
Yeah, that was bad.
He got 4,200 votes. So he got to, I think, the sixth count.
Yeah. That seems to me that was a...
For a former minister,
and
a sitting senator, someone who's getting into the news a lot now, mostly about vaping, but who's in the news.
Yeah.
To only get 4,200?
And he comes, and he was a former health minister, but and he had a high profile, and he's a very recognisable figure. Now, I know, again, with all the caveats about low turnout and all that, the other one that I was interested in seeing was how George Lawler would run in Wexford.
I didn't check out how George did. How did he do?
George, I think, in the context of the overall, he did pretty well. When you're looking where you have a turnout at 35%, right? Now, remember, it's not like Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael where you're going to be running multiple candidates. Labour will be running one candidate in the by-election and one candidate in the general. But with a 35% turnout, Lawler got 8,000 first preferences and 20% of the vote. And actually, after the fourth count, bypassed Verona Murphy and went into the final count, the fifth count, with Malcolm Byrne. Now, he was never going to come near Malcolm. He was 4,000 votes behind him. But he finishes up on 14,000 votes. Now, on a 35% turnout, 8,000 first preferences. Now, we don't know if Brendan Howland, the current leader of the Labour Party and the current holder of the Labour seat, Wexford, is going to run again in the next general election, whenever that is. And maybe his decision will be dependent on when that is. If it's only in the next couple of months, then probably you will. But Brendan has been there a long time now. I think Brendan got elected back, off the top of my head, Brendan Corrish didn't run, and then his brother Richard ran in, I think, 1981 and didn't take the seat, which is the only occasion that Labour didn't take a seat in Wexford since 1918, on the basis that Brendan Corrish's father took a seat for Sinn Féin in 1918. That's a fairly decent run for a party like the Labour Party. That is you're 100 years, seven occasions, two seats. But Howland is a massive figure and with a large personal following. So the question was, when Howland goes, what happens to the Labour vote? Well, I would say that this is good news for the Labour vote. Now, George Lawler is a very personable person. He's popular in Wexford town. He's a good profile. So he's a good candidate.
I mean, hopefully these people also have time to actually get used to their office before they're back on the campaign trail. But one thing I did find particularly interesting is that when Lawler goes into second place,
yeah,
Verona Murphy is behind him by 71 votes.
Yes.
And they don't ask for a recount.
Well,
71 votes, though.
You know, if they might ask even, but the returning officer might say, listen, it's not going to have any material effect on the outcome of the election. And I'm not going to...
Oh, no, I think a returning officer with 71 votes separating them would allow it. Now, then again, Lawler is Labour. Is that going to go more to Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael? I mean, I don't think it would have changed the end result. But I absolutely think if you go to a returning officer and go to 71 votes, do it again. I think they'd probably do it.
Listen, my observation is simply this, and I accept, again, your caveats about the low turnout, but the fact remains that on the fourth count, Labour, holding one seat and running one candidate, are on 10,009. Fine Gael, holding two seats and probably running three candidates, if they're running Verona, they're also on 10,800 votes. Not brilliant news. Also, just considering it's a by-election, and as you say, it tends to be the most motivated people who will vote in these circumstances. It's interesting to me. The Greens, I suppose you can say, are maybe I don't suppose it's fair to call them a fringe group, but there's no sign of an angry breakthrough movement happening at all. If you look at in Wexford, you've got the Solidarity People Before Profit getting 1.6% of the vote. The Irish Freedom Party took 489 votes. This is, you know, however, not a bad result for AIM2, I think.
Not a bad result for AIM2, not a bad result for Gemma O'Doherty. I was talking to some of the Freedom Party guys. The basic guy said that they had no expectation of doing terribly well in this. They just wanted to get run someone, get people on the ground, and start basically showing people how it's done.
It struck me, is AIM2 the party that could possibly occupy that quadrant that is empty at the moment?
The sort of left on economic matters, conservative on cultural?
Yeah.
They could. I think Paddy Turbine is a good man. He's a very good man.
Yes.
I think some of the opinions in that quadrant are opinions he would struggle to publicly support, because he doesn't privately support them.
I think that's true.
I think that is the issue there. I will say this, it was a fine showing for them. They did better than the Social Democrats. I think at this point we can broadly say the Social Democrats are two independent TDs who are being, I would imagine, most likely being hurt by the Social Democratic brand.
What?
I don't think those people will get elected on their own. At this point, I think it's a bit of an albatross. I will also say this, I try never to speak ill of anyone who will run an election, because it's awful.
Yes, it is
awful. And you know, I think you have to respect people who are like, my ideas are terrible, but I'm going to let the public publicly say that they're terrible.
Yes, it's a personal experience.
But this was a very difficult election. There were a couple of candidates here where when I saw how badly they had failed, there was a little bit of a good. And oftentimes not the obvious candidates, just people I know to be awful.
You're right. For the listener who may not have Jim Codd, who was coming out of Bridgetown, which wouldn't be the best geographical position to be. He would have been fairly close to Verona Murphy on one side of him and George Lawler on the other side. He got 2,000 votes. Now, we can, in fairness, do that, but if we're to extrapolate that on a higher turnout, he might do better. Put it this way. If they were to be able to replicate that kind of vote around the country, they would be in a position to be looking at getting the 2% required for funding.
Yeah, I mean, if they could get the 2% of funding and they can get Padder re-elected,
yeah,
which will be interesting because Sinn Féin are going to throw resources at that.
Absolutely, yeah.
They're going to try and slaughter him. They could do something, but it's a case of, you know, how good are they on the ground? How many people can they actually put in? How much money are they going to have come the general election?
Yes, and that's going to be a big problem.
The difference between having a little bit of money and a lot of money is not as big as people think. But the difference between having a little bit of money and basically no money,
yes,
is incredible.
And just my last comment and observation is, Sinn Féin take the seat, all right. I wonder how much that is about Sinn Féin and how much that is about a very active local party which was able to get the vote out, and in the context of such a low turnout, that was what really made a massive difference.
I mean, it's difficult to tell in a by-election because the national parties, it's very easy to just pump canvassers,
yeah,
into those sections because you have an entire country's worth of canvassers and party members who just need to go to one, well, in this case four, but usually just one or two places. But
also Sinn Féin historically has been the party in Ireland most capable of doing that.
I don't know, because as we saw in the European election, their ground game seemed a little bit all over the place.
Yeah, but their ability to get bodies into a constituency for a campaign, for a canvas.
I'm actually really curious if they can keep that up, because I think after the water protests and they brought in more people from that, they grew because they took those positions. But I think a lot of the people who've gone into Sinn Féin don't have, shall we say, the same socioeconomic background and zest for campaigning that older Sinn Féin members generally have.
Well, what they used to do, I don't know if they still do it, they used to bring them down from the north.
I'm not sure if that's legal.
Well, why not? You're bringing people from the...
That strikes me as the sort of thing which could be considered a donation.
Most of these people would be Irish citizens.
I suppose that's fair, Michael, although with the recent court cases in the north, they're also British citizens. Whether or not they want to be.
Whether or not they want to be. But my point, if you look at Johnny Mython, and Johnny's a good candidate, and he's a nice guy, and he's well-liked. However, well, he lost his seat in the locals. He gets 10% in Wexford, and you're asking, will Malcolm take the seat? Well, a lot of that, I think, will be down to Johnny Mython and Sinn Féin. I don't think this is great news. 4,000 first preferences. Because remember the seat that Malcolm is fighting. And this is what makes it perhaps more likely for him. It's a better news story for him, in a sense, for taking the seat. Is Mick Wallace's seat. So it's not a Labour seat or a Fine Gael seat or even a Sinn Féin seat that he's taking. It's an independent seat. Fine Gael are not going to take an extra seat in Wexford. They're not going to take three seats. I am willing, if anybody wants to ring me up and take a bet on that, I am very happy to take that bet.
I'll include Michael's phone number in the description of this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. But only for bets over a certain level. Labour are not going to take another seat. So the question is, either some Mick Wallace-type figure comes out of the woodwork, or Dr. Toomey-type figure from a previous election comes out of the woodwork and launches an insurgency as an independent, or it's going to be Sinn Féin. And I just have a feeling that both in Wexford and nationally, Sinn Féin is a little bit treading water.
When you said someone like Mick Wallace, all I could think of, you mean someone bankrupt?
Someone bankrupt, but still, what's the MEP salary these days?
It's better than the TD's salary.
It's around 100. It must be 100 grand anyway.
I think the expense account is quite nice.
I think the expense account is feather bed. So you know, for a bankrupt, he's doing okay. Anyway, I know Malcolm well. Myself and himself were involved in the dark, on the dark side back in the '80s. He was only a whippersnapper when he first joined the party. And he has stuck at it. And there he is today. Deputy Malcolm Byrne, and congratulations.
Long may he reign.
Long may he reign indeed. So, I suppose we shall be back on Monday, reflecting on other more, more interesting or more salubrious issues. But for the now, I suppose we'll let people get on with their Sundays.
All the best.
Bye-bye.